Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Okay, hi everyone, and welcome back to the New Books Network Animal Studies channel. My name is Kyle Johansson, and I'm a host on this channel. Today, I'm very happy to be interviewing Dr. Melanie Joy. Melanie is a Harvard-educated psychologist and the author of 7 books. She is also the founding president of the international NGO Beyond Carnism. Today, we'll be discussing her book, The Vegan Matrix, Understanding and Discussing Privilege Among Vegans to Build a More Inclusive and Empowered Movement. This book was published in 2020 by Lantern Media and Publishing. Welcome to the podcast, Melanie.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks. It's great to have you here. Could you just start things off by just telling us a bit about yourself, such as where you're from, the sort of work you do, or really anything else you think that listeners might want to know about you?
Sure. I'm a psychologist. I'm an author, as you've pointed out. I'm probably best known, or not probably, I am best known for my book, Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows, which actually forms the foundation for The Vegan Matrix, which we'll talk about in a little bit. My work basically looks at why rational and compassionate people support irrational and harmful practices and how to change this. So I specialize in the psychology of social change and in building healthy relationships, which includes effective communication. I'm also the founding president of Beyond Carnism. Our mission is to expose and transform carnism globally, which we'll talk about briefly. And we run the Center for Effective Vegan Advocacy, where we train people who want to talk about veganism or empower veganism, empower the movement to do this more effectively. I'm originally from the U.S., from Boston, actually, it's where I spent most of my life in the U.S. And for the past, what is it now? Just about 9 years, I've been living in Berlin, Germany. So that's where I'm based now.
Right. Okay. Well, yeah, thanks. And the work you do with the Center for Effective Vegan Advocacy. That's the name of it, right? The Center for Effective Vegan Advocacy?
Yeah, that's our main program through Beyond Carnism.
Yeah, okay. And it sounds like the book I'm about to be interviewing you about here is very closely related to that. It's almost an expression of it or something.
Yeah, it's actually, interestingly, it's an expression of sort of both dimensions of the organization. But yes, definitely. How do we communicate about critical social issues, work to raise awareness when we're communicating about an issue that tends to automatically create defensiveness in the listener?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll ask you about the book really soon, but there's some stuff that's interesting about you that I wanted to ask about. So one cool thing about you is that you won something called the AHIMSA Award, I think back in 2013. This award has been given out, I think, something like 15 times so far, and it's associated with an international group that's part of Jainism. But the past winners of this award include people such as Nelson Mandela, the Dalai Lama, and King Charles, formerly known as Prince Charles, also won this award at one point. It sounds like it's a big, really big deal to have won this award. Like, I was hoping you might comment on that or say something about it.
I mean, well, when I was granted the award, the Center for Genealogy, I think it is, the Institute of Genealogy is, I think, what they're called. I hadn't heard of them before, but they reached out to me back in 2012, I think, and just said, you know, we've been following your work. And they're not, Jains are, you know, a religious group, but they're, you know, many of them are, like, the most religious Jains tend to be vegan, but many, many Jains are actually not. And the people who hosted me were not. They were vegetarian, but not vegan. So I was very excited because I had this opportunity to give a speech at the House of Commons in London, you know, and get the award and really raise awareness of this, you know, critical issue of animal exploitation and talk about the consumption of dairy and talk about, you know, how eating animals is not in alignment with ahimsa, which is, you know, nonviolence, a central tenet of Jainism. So it was a very interesting experience and a great experience, actually, to be connecting with people and having these conversations and using the opportunity, of course, to raise awareness.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, cool. Okay. Another neat thing about you. So you recently started a podcast with actor and activist Ivana Lynch. You're co-hosting a podcast called Just Beings. And this podcast just finished its first season. I've listened to a few episodes. It's a neat podcast. Do you want to say something about it, maybe?
Oh, thank you. Ivana and I started this podcast just this year, and we wanted a podcast where we could talk about, we could basically invite people who are doing, you know, any kind of work to help create a better world for humans, animals, non-human animals, or the planet, to, you know, thought leaders, essentially, or people who are working to change the way that we think to create a better world, to, you know, to sort of to discuss their work and in each conversation, you know, really to talk about the commonality between all of these different, you know, issues, whether we're talking about, you know, justice for animals, justice for the environment, you know, or justice for humans, you know, how they all share this common denominator and sort of rely on a common approach to transformation. So it's a way to invite people into conversations about veganism who are not vegan, but who are very justice oriented and vice versa.
Okay. And so this will maybe become clearer to listeners as we go through, but I think this is another area where there's a close connection between work you're doing elsewhere kind of, and also this book you wrote, I think.
Yes.
Well, anyways, it'll be. We should maybe just talk about the book because it won't be obvious until we've talked about the book that the Just Beings podcast is actually pretty closely related to the book.
It is.
So this book, The Vegan Matrix. Why did you decide to write it?
Well, so by the time I wrote The Vegan Matrix, I was already well known in the animal protection movement or the vegan movement, you know, but almost entirely for my work on carnism, which was popularized in Why We Love Dogs. And in fact, this is the work that formed the foundation of The Vegan Matrix in some ways. So I'll just give a brief explanation about that work and, you know, how I came to write Why We Love Dogs and how that evolved into The Vegan Matrix, because The Vegan Matrix is really an extension of these thoughts that I put together for Why We Love Dogs. I wrote Why We Love Dogs, the 10th anniversary edition was recently published. It was first published in 2010, actually, and I wrote Why We Love Dogs after becoming vegan myself, and like basically waking up to the reality that information alone is not enough to help shift harmful attitudes and behaviors. Like, you know, I used to have this belief that like if only people knew the truth about what was going wrong in the world, you know, they would never want to participate in these atrocities again. But as you well know, I'm sure listeners well know, more often than not, you know, the information doesn't sell the ideology. So Why We Love Dogs grew out of my own life experience. You know, I grew up like many people, certainly in the West, you know, with a dog who I loved. And I was always someone who really cared about animals, who cared about justice. I come from a family that's very justice oriented. I would never have, you know, wanted to support violence against non-human animals. And yet, of course, I grew up eating meat, eggs, and dairy. And, you know, I just never made the connection between the meat, eggs, and dairy on my plate and the living being it once was, or those once were, until 1989. I was 23 at the time, and I ate a contaminated hamburger and I wound up in the hospital on intravenous antibiotics. I was just beyond sick. And after that experience, I stopped eating meat, not because I had made any sort of ethical connection, at least not on a conscious level. But it just, I was, you know, when you're so sick, you're just disgusted by the last thing you ate, and it just makes you sick to think about it. So I was like, ah, never eating meat again. So I kind of became a vegetarian by accident. And then in this process of learning to shop and cook for myself, I, of course, stumbled on information about animal agriculture. And what I learned just completely shocked and horrified me. I could not believe the extent of the harm that was being done to non-human animals, you know, and also the environment and also to human consumers. And this was like 89. So there wasn't a lot. There was enough known back then, but nothing compared to what we know today. So I was just completely shocked and horrified. I met a vegan shortly after this. I became vegan shortly after that. But anyway, what shocked me in some ways even more was that nobody I talked to about what I was learning was willing to hear what I had to say, you know? And these were like rational people. They were compassionate people. These were my friends and family members. They were justice-oriented people. They were people who cared about animals, you know, just like I had been all my life. And yet their response to the information I was sharing was always like, you know, something like, don't tell me that you'll ruin my meal, or they'd call me a radical vegan hippie propagandist. Like they just, you know, they just shut down the conversation. And I was just like, what the hell is going on here? I felt like I had woken up in the midst of like collective insanity, which I did, you know, I had. So this led me to become very curious, you know, as to how rational, compassionate people could basically just check their critical thinking at the door, just stop thinking and feeling when it came to this issue of eating animals. And I eventually, enrolled in a psychology program, a PhD program in psychology. And I studied the psychology of, at the time I was calling it violence and nonviolence, you know, broadly. And then I narrowed down the focus of my research for my doctoral dissertation to the psychology of eating animals. And this was what led me to write Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows, which is based on my findings from that research. And the key finding that I took away was, that the reason we eat, you know, I almost said dogs, the reason we eat pigs but not dogs, for instance, is because we have been conditioned by an invisible belief system that I came to call carnism. So carnism is the invisible belief system that conditions us to eat certain animals. And it's essentially the opposite of veganism. And what I did in my dissertation and then unpacked in my book, which was, you know, written for a popular audience, it wasn't an academic book, was really try to understand, I really look at and analyze the structure of carnism. Like, what is the system? How is it structured? And, you know, specifically, how does it shape our mentality? I call it the carnistic mentality, so that people can eat animals, you know, and act against their core moral values and their own interests and the interests of others. You know, people who we know are hardwired to feel empathy for others, including other animals. What is this mentality? And so that's really what my work was. It was deconstructing, it was naming and then deconstructing the system and specifically looking at the psychological mechanisms that keep it intact. And what I came away with was actually much more than an analysis of what I was calling carnism. It was actually a blueprint for all systems of oppression, right? All of these systems, carnism, patriarchy, classism, racism, speciesism, and so on. I mean, they all share a very similar structure. They're all structured in the same way. And, you know, even though the victims of each of these systems, you know, will the experience of the victims of each of these systems will always be unique. It's not appropriate to compare the experience of the victims, of course. The systems themselves are structurally similar. And the most importantly, the mentality that enables these systems is the same. And so I worked for, you know, after writing Why We Love Dogs, I founded Beyond Carnism. And it wasn't until, and my focus was really on carnism awareness, like raising awareness of carnism and empowering vegans, so, or anybody who's promoting veganism, right, to be able to understand and talk about the issue, you know, raise awareness and advocate, given this sort of like defensive structure that is created in people's mentalities, right? So how do you talk to somebody who's basically been conditioned to be defensive against everything you say to them about eating animals, right? So, so that's really, you know, it wasn't until 2018 that I started expanding my writing. And I, you know, in 2018, I started writing about other forms of oppression. So in the animal protection movement, where my work was quite well known at that time, what wasn't known about me is that I wore these other hats, and I hadn't been vocal about them in the ways that I have become lately, simply because I was at capacity and other people were, you know, doing work. I felt like I didn't need to fill any gaps. In 2018, I wrote a series of online essays about privilege and oppression in the vegan movement, you know, or among vegans, you know, about patriarchy and racism and classism, other isms, you know, other problems. And then in 2019, I wrote a book about the psychology of oppression more broadly. And then after that, I was also writing about this other hat, like the work that reflects this other hat that I've worn for many, many years, is a relationship specialist and a relationship coach. And so, you know, all of these different hats sort of started to synthesize. And in 2020, I published The Vegan Matrix, which is sort of it's an amalgam of these sort of newer works. I hadn't wanted to write The Vegan Matrix before 2020, or even before 2018, in part because, like I said, I was really at capacity. You know, I started this organization, Beyond Carnism, and it was like, I mean, I describe it sort of as an unplanned pregnancy. Like, I had this book, Why We Love Dogs, and people were like writing me and wanting me to speak and having all these questions. And it was like, I had to do something. So I put up this website and I called it Carnism Awareness and Action Website Network. And it kind of turned into an organization. So, you know, I was basically at capacity sort of running the organization, trying to raise awareness about carnism and so on. But then, you know, at the height of AR Me Too, you know, I felt like I really had to start doing some writing. I felt like, you know, I had already been feeling guilty that I wasn't using my platform to raise awareness of other issues, you know, especially issues that I was personally familiar with and also really passionate about. And so what people didn't know about me is that I had been active in social justice causes, you know, since the 1980s. I was part of the Boston chapter of Feminists for Animal Rights back in the early 90s, and I taught university courses on privilege and oppression and feminism and related issues for over a decade, you know. And as a woman, I was no stranger to patriarchy, sexism in the vegan movement. And like for many years in the movement, I had tried alongside other women unsuccessfully to raise awareness of male privilege, you know, among many of my colleagues for many, many years, and, you know, and also of other forms of privilege as well. And I'd consistently been met with a tremendous amount of resistance, and it was very, very frustrating for me. And I would experience the same thing from vegans. Like when I would talk to vegans about patriarchy, you know, I would very often get the same kind of response that I used to get when I would talk to non-vegans about eating animals. So I felt like it was just, you know, I also knew that there were other people doing this really important work in the vegan movement. You know, there's like the work of Syl and AFCO and Lisa Kemmerer, you know, people were writing on these topics, you know, so I felt like, well, I don't need to be writing on them. I'll start talking about them, but I don't need to write a book. I hate writing books. Why would I ever write another book? Which I basically say every time I write a book. But, you know, but then I came to realize that like there are these amazing materials out there. But there wasn't something that I felt like was just a super straightforward, actionable guide for vegans who really want to understand the very basics of what privilege is and how to talk about it in a way that increases the chances that their message will be heard as they intend it to be. And so that was the impetus and the background.
Okay. Yeah, no, you know, thanks for all that. I take it the hashtag MeToo movement, and I guess more specifically hashtag animal rights MeToo, it was sort of an opportunity for you. So the Vegan Matrix was something you maybe would have been interested in writing in the past, but you didn't feel like people in the vegan movement would have listened or really been interested. But now there's all this interest, right?
Yes. And what I noticed was that this was the first time that a lot of my colleagues who I had been really trying to talk to about these issues started to pay attention. And they were like, okay, maybe there is a problem here. And I'm like, yeah, I've been saying this for 30 years, but whatever. Yes, there is a problem. And they were really open. And then they were coming to me. They're like, well, give me something. Where should I go? What should I read? Because this is what happens, right? Like, okay, I will find the right things for you to read so you don't have to look yourself. But people were coming to me. A lot of people were actually coming to me asking for resources. And there are good resources out there, very good ones, but there wasn't anything that was like basically like privilege 101 and like speaking in a way. They all to some degree required either a level of sophistication that's not the right word, but a level of like education around the issues to begin with. And some of them were, you know, a little bit just too off-putting for people who are highly sensitive to these issues. So that was really the impetus for writing the book.
Okay, yeah. Okay, well, let's get into the content of the book. So one of the main ideas in The Vegan Matrix is that various matrices affect or distort our perception of the world, of ourselves, and of other people. I was hoping you could explain what this idea of a matrix is, as well as the relationship between the idea of a matrix and the concepts of privilege and oppression.
So I was using the analogy of the matrix, like from the movie of the same name, basically to describe how dominant certain types of dominant systems, and here we're talking about systems of oppression, psychologically affect us. You know, so systems, like I said, like Carnism, patriarchy, racism, and so on, you know, these dominant systems. When a system is dominant, it basically means that its tenets are so widespread that, you know, they're invisible. They're basically woven through the very structure of society to shape norms, laws, beliefs, behaviors, et cetera, you know, and they become institutionalized. And when we're born into a dominant system, you know, we end up looking at the world through the lens of that system. We internalize it, you know, so we internalize this mentality. And I briefly mentioned earlier, you know, what I call the carnistic mentality, right? And it's this distorted mentality. Carnism, let me back up and use carnism as an example for listeners who are wondering what I mean by this kind of mentality, right? This privileged mentality that, you know, in one case, when we're talking about eating animals, it's expressed through what I would call carnistic privilege. And I also want to say that I do not mean to suggest that carnistic privilege is the same as, for example, male privilege or white privilege or, you know, privileges that are, you know, causing very like widespread systemic harm to people all around the world. I use this as simply as an example to help people who are vegan, who may not recognize other forms of privilege easily, to have something to identify with. So carnism and systems of oppression in general are like they run counter to the core values that most people experience, that most people hold. You know, values, compassion and justice are the most obvious ones. Most people would never like willingly support these systems, not consciously support these systems. And yet most people actually do support these systems, participate in them in different ways. So systems such as carnism need to use a set of psychological defense mechanisms. These are ways of thinking so that we act against our values and our interests without realizing what we're doing. These psychological defense mechanisms distort our perceptions and disconnect us from our authentic feelings so that we act against our values, right? And we don't see it. So just as a quick example, you know, for listeners who are, you know, probably, you know, vegan themselves, right? So when it comes to carnism, we learn, for example, to think of, or people, most people learn to see farmed animals as abstractions, right? So we learn to think that farmed animals, you know, are lacking any personality or any individuality of their own. A pig is a pig and all pigs are the same. This is a defense mechanism. This is a distancing mechanism. This distances people from the reality of the animals that they're eating. So these defense mechanisms distort our perceptions, right? Such that we end up defending our right, our privilege, our right to participate in the oppression without realizing what we're doing. So, you know, you talk to a non-vegan and all you have to do is say, I'm vegan. and immediately you can feel the wall go up, right? Or, you know, very often that person will start telling you all the reasons that veganism is wrong, even though they never even heard the word until 5 minutes ago when you first mentioned it. Like, there's all of these defensive reactions. That's their privilege. That's their carnistic mentality, which is organized around their privilege, their sense of entitlement, their belief that they have a right to eat animals. And, you know, and they're entitled to continue doing this. And so privilege distorts. We can think of our privilege, whatever kind of privilege, as an entity that's basically hijacked our psyche. And it wants to keep itself alive. And anything, you know, it causes us to feel defensive against anyone or anything that actually challenges it. And so when I talk about the matrix, like this internalized, you know, this internalized way of thinking, that's what I'm referring to, is this psychology, this privileged mentality. And so, you know, very often vegans, you know, feel like, I've met many, many vegans, and this is understandable, it's just not accurate, you know, that somehow, like, once you've examined your human privilege, you know, you've reached the final frontier. Like, well, wait a minute, you know, I'm thinking about my impact on animals. So, like, I must have gotten to the final frontier. And without realizing that you're plugged into all of these other matrices, you know, whether it's male privilege or white privilege or, you know, whatever else, you are plugged into them because you have been socialized in these widespread systems. And there is absolutely no way that you're not influenced by them. There's no way you haven't internalized this way of thinking. And the only way to really change this is to commit to becoming aware of, and we could talk specifically about this, what is privilege, you know, how does it affect me, you know, and how is it manifested? Because when you become aware of it, it has less power over you.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So I take it the vegan matrix is sort of like the collection of matrices that vegans are, perceptions are distorted by, but sans carnism. Like, so carnism is itself a kind of matrix that vegans have, by and large, not maybe not entirely, but somewhat overcome. But there are all these other matrices that some, at least many vegans may not have thought much about or become, yes, sufficiently aware of, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah. You know, we assume that, like, when we step out of one oppressive system, right, yeah, then we've somehow stepped out of all of them. But, like, usually, you know, we step out of one and we stay, you know, immersed in others unless we actively commit to becoming, right, aware of those other systems.
Right. Okay. Well, so let's, I guess we'll explore this further. So an important claim that you make in your book, and which you explore at length in another of your books, I know, is that all systems of oppression share the same psychological structure. And you refer to this structure as powerarchy. I was hoping you could explain this concept to us, what powerarchy is.
Okay, well, so I wrote this book called Powerarchy back. It was published back in 2019, and I've stopped using the term because I found that it was getting confusing for people. But the concept remains, and I've actually revised that book and rewritten it such that it's coming out as a new book called How to End Injustice Everywhere, and I'll explain the premise of it so it'll make sense for people. You know, this, when we look at, as I said earlier, when we look at these systems of oppression, you know, we can see that they're structured similarly, and we can see that they all share the same, like, they all are based on the same mentality. The mentality that enables us to carry out violence and support oppression is the same. The content changes, right? Who we're supporting violence or oppression to may change, but the mentality itself actually stays the same. This mentality is based on a core belief. This is a belief in a hierarchy of moral worth, the belief that some individuals or groups are more worthy of moral consideration, of being, basically, to simplify this, of being treated with respect than others, right? So the particular individual being targeted changes, the content changes, who is oppressing whom changes, but the mentality and the core belief remain consistent. So when you look at all forms of oppression and also abuse, they are based on this core belief in a hierarchy of moral worth. Again, that some individuals or groups are more worthy of moral consideration or of being treated with respect than others. I originally referred to this mentality as powerarchy, the powerarchical mentality. That turned out to be confusing for people. Power is a piece of a whole, but it's not the core of the whole. I now refer to this mentality exclusively as the non-relational mentality. It's because this mentality causes us to interact, to relate, or to interact with others, and also with ourselves. We're always relating to ourselves, but to interact with others in a way that causes harm to our relationships and to the individuals, right? So it causes harm to relationships between individuals and also among social groups. And it also creates, this mentality is what creates and grows unjust power imbalances. So when we look at these systems of oppression, right, these are, and I'll get into this a little bit more because I know we're going to be talking a bit about how relational dysfunction plays a role in oppression. And kind of leading into this now, but it's in these systems of oppression I refer to as non-relational systems. These systems are actually organized to create harm to the relationships between individuals or relationships between humans and non-humans, relationships between social groups, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Great. And I do want to ask you about relational dysfunction in a moment. With respect to I guess you don't like the term powerarchy anymore. But so you make this distinction between the structure and content of oppression, and so different kinds of oppression share the same structure, but each have different content. I take it this is like a useful distinction to make. So the fact that like all so if this is right, that all forms of oppression share the same structure, it's useful to learn about that structure. Like, you're going to be able to combat oppression more effectively, understand it better, if you understand the common structure across types of oppression. But if content is different, it's not going to be enough to learn about just one type of oppression. Like, adequately understanding each kind of oppression requires understanding everything that's in the content of each type. Like, so you still need to like make an effort to learn about each kind. You can't just learn about one kind and think you understand all of it or something.
Exactly. Right? And both are important. You said that really, really well, actually. Yeah. Thank you for that. So it's kind of what I was trying to say, but you summarized it very succinctly. It's not enough to simply look at who is oppressing or abusing whom. Like, we have to ask how and why we oppress and abuse in the first place, right? So it's important to understand oppressive and abusive dynamics. So oppressive dynamics happen are institutionalized, and abusive dynamics are basically the exact same dynamics, but they happen on more of an interpersonal level. But you know, it's not enough to ask just who is oppressing or abusing whom. We really need to understand why and how we oppress and abuse in the first place, or we're just going to trade one form of oppression for another. You know, we'll stop oppressing one group, but when we maintain the mentality that caused us to participate in oppression in the first place, then we just direct that mentality toward another group. And especially when it comes to those of us who are working towards social transformation, we can see this mentality, this non-relational mentality, right? This that's organized around this belief in a hierarchy of moral worth. We can see that unless we really understand this mentality and unpack it and learn how to sort of decondition and recondition ourselves, we keep replicating it. And you can see this in our social justice movements. You know, a lot of our groups and movements themselves are cannibalizing themselves because we haven't examined this mentality. You know, and when we talk about like this hierarchy of moral worth, we may not be talking about, you know, treating or causing harm to those who have less power or who are non-human animals, who have a different color skin than we do or a different accent than we do. We carry out the same mentality, however, when we look at people who are, you know, supposedly less compassionate than we are, who don't believe with our political beliefs, who agree with our political beliefs, who are acting in ways that we perceive as harmful, you know. And so we really can start, you can see within groups and movements that we start treating each other in the very ways, you know, we start basically becoming the very thing that we're trying to transform. So if we want to end oppression, essentially, we really need to change the way that we relate.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Let's talk about relationships, which is something else you've written a lot about this. So in this book in particular, in The Vegan Matrix, in chapter 2, you look at various ways in which privilege can be harmful. But you talk about one type of harm at one point, namely the harm that privilege does to relationships. And it struck me when reading it that this is a sufficiently broad kind of harm that it probably captures some of the other harms you talk about too. So I was hoping you could further explain to us the connection between privilege and relational dysfunction.
Sure. I mean, I'll start on a meta level, and then I can talk about, you know, what this looks like on an interpersonal, you know, on a more individual level. So, you know, when you look at some of the most pressing problems, right, in our personal lives, but also in our world, like, you know, war and poverty and domestic abuse, animal exploitation, climate change, patriarchy, you know, racism, and so on, right? You can see that, like, all of these problems share a common denominator. I mean, they share many common denominators, but one key common denominator that they share is relational dysfunction. Relational dysfunction is dysfunctional ways of relating, you know, dysfunctional ways of relating between individuals, between social groups, between humans and non-human animals, between humans and the environment. And, you know, as I said, also between us and ourselves, but I'll leave that out for now. And so what this means is that, you know, a common denominator in addressing and helping to transform all of these problems is relational literacy, which is the understanding of and ability to practice healthy ways of relating. I mean, I always say that, like, I'm just amazed that we, you know, most of us have to learn complicated geometry in our lives that we'll probably never need to use, and we don't get a single formal lesson on how to relate in a way that's healthy. And when you look at the problems in the world, they are not problems that are caused by people who don't know how to do geometry, right? So systems, you know, I should unpack privilege a little bit, right? So these systems of oppression, you know, or these non-relational systems that I've been referring to are, you know, organized around privileging, and many, many people have written about this, right? Organized, you know, to maintain themselves by privileging certain individuals and groups and disadvantaging others and conditioning us to act in ways that maintain these privileges and disadvantages. And so, I mean, a privilege is basically just an advantage that's given to some and denied to others, you know, and something is only a privilege if some people don't have it. If everybody has the same advantage, then it's no longer an advantage. Now, you know, what we're talking about, people, when they talk about oppressions, they're talking about unearned privileges. An earned privilege is like a driver's license, right? You have to earn the right to drive a vehicle. But an unearned privilege is a privilege that, you know, you've done nothing to earn, you know, so you've been born into or inherited. And, you know, when you have, you know, and the flip side of privilege is oppression. And, you know, and so some people are privileged and some people are what are called oppressed or disadvantaged, or we can say some animals as well. What happens is that, you know, a lot of time we internalize the mentality that goes along with whatever role we play in a system, right? So if you're in a privileged role in a system, if you're in a position of greater power in a system or greater privilege in a system, you've internalized a certain way of thinking that causes you to interact with others in a way that don't share your privilege, right? In a way that harms relationships. Literally, many, many vegans, I mean, I've heard this over and over again. I've heard this from, you know, people in experiencing all different types of, you know, privileged and disadvantaged dynamics, talk about how the people in their lives make jokes and talk to them in ways that drive them away, that cause them to feel disconnected and insecure in their family members or their friends' presence, when their family members and friends have no idea that their behaviors are having this impact. Because when you have privilege, you tend to be, you know, very unaware of the fact that you're having this impact on others.
Mm-hmm. Okay, right. Well, thankfully, there are ways to mitigate the harms of privilege, and your book discusses it. So your book suggests that one of the best ways we can mitigate or even prevent the harm that our privilege can cause is by becoming privilege literate. I was hoping you could explain the idea of privilege literacy.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically building awareness, right? And when you become aware, you know, awareness is both a cognitive or an intellectual endeavor, and it's also emotional, right? So when you're aware, you really, you know, you understand, as you rightly pointed out, you know, you understand the general, like, structure and nature of oppression in general, but you also understand the structure and nature and manifestations of specific types of oppression as well. And it's not just understanding, you know, intellectual, it's also empathizing with those who don't share your privilege, you know, with those who are disadvantaged because of your privilege. And it's being willing to listen and learn.
Mm-hmm. Okay, right. I like this. I think this is a really useful concept, or it strikes me as very useful. Because you discuss this in the book a bit, but privilege is kind of a tricky thing because on the one hand, whether one is privileged is a product of circumstance. Usually, one is often born into their privilege. They're, you know, born with male genitalia and thus socialized to be male, or they're born into a wealthy family or what have you. So on the one hand, privilege is itself the product of circumstance by and large, but we also want to be able to hold people responsible for their behavior, the behavior that's caused by their privilege or associated with their privilege. And it seemed to me that the idea of privilege literacy is useful for navigating that, because we can acknowledge that people are not responsible for their privilege, but they are responsible for the way they relate to their privilege. They can be held responsible for either, you know, becoming privilege literate or failing to become privilege literate. I'm a philosopher as my background, and philosophically, I thought it was useful for navigating that kind of trickiness associated with privilege.
Yeah, absolutely, and you know, it's also tricky. Like, these conversations are very, very tricky to have, and you know, it's very important to sort of realize that when you have more, there have been some interesting studies on how power affects us, and privilege is a form of power, right? And these studies have found that when you're in any position of power, right, like say you're a boss and you've got somebody working for you, you know, you are actually likely to develop certain attitudes and feelings that cause you to abuse that power. So just having power increases the chances that you will abuse the power. Even if you're somebody who's really egalitarian in your philosophy and would never want to abuse power. So for instance, you're more likely to believe that, to feel entitled to break the rules and that others shouldn't, to basically apply a double standard to yourself. So for instance, if you're the boss, you are much more likely to get angry at somebody who works for you showing up late to a meeting, than you are to feel angry at yourself or expect others to be angry at you when you're the one who shows up late. Also, when you're in a position of power, you are less likely to empathize with others than they are to empathize with you. So, you know, it's really important to be aware of, because it just happens, you know, it happens to all of us. And so knowing the way that we're psychologically affected is really key. Also recognizing that, you know, you're less likely when you have privilege, you're less likely to, you're more likely to feel that your opinions and needs and experiences are more important than others and more valid than those of others. Just knowing that can go a long way to helping mitigate the tendency to act on that.
Right. Okay. This is tricky. Here's another source of trickiness. I don't know how far I want to go down the trickiness rabbit hole, but one source of trickiness is it strikes me that the opportunity to become privilege literate is itself circumstantial to a large extent. So one mm-hmm. who is born into a country or into a family with sufficient resources for one to have a lot of educational opportunities. Having educational opportunities, I think, probably greatly expands one's ability to become privilege literate. Whereas someone who was not fortunate enough to have much in the way of educational opportunities, but still has mm-hmm. other forms of privilege will not really be able to, it'll be a lot harder to become literate with respect to those other forms of privilege.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of gray area. I mean, it's important to, you know, realize that beneath somebody's, you know, privilege, and we all occupy privileged and disadvantaged roles, right? And not all forms of privilege and disadvantage are equally harmful, of course, you know, but all of us occupy some privileged and some disadvantaged roles and or positions in society. And it's important to remember that, like, underneath our role as a person, you know, and when you're advocating to somebody, if you're a person who's, you know, working to raise awareness of somebody else's privilege, for instance, like you may be rightfully very angry, you know, anger is the emotional response to injustice, to witnessing injustice. And, you know, and anger is, it's a really important emotion. Your anger is an indication that your moral compass is working. Generally, it's an indication that your moral compass is working. And, you know, our anger inspires us to take action on our own and others' behalf. And at the same time, it's important to realize and just remember that underneath a person's privilege is a being, is a human being. And it's like, it's on that level that the communication, you know, would ideally take place, or at least remembering that and keeping that in mind. And I mean, this is true for, you know, any kind of awareness raising. Again, like, you know, many people who are advocating veganism, they struggle so much because they're like, oh, they're talking to non-vegans, and in their mind, the non-vegan is like this selfish, lazy, you know, whatever, you know, fill in the blank adjective we might apply to them. You don't care about anybody, but you're, you know, all you care about are your taste buds while animals die. And, you know, I mean, it's true. Animals are being harmed and killed needlessly to satisfy, you know, human consumers. There's no question about that. And it's also true that, you know, people are more than their behaviors. And, you know, it's underneath the difference in our, you know, sort of attitudes and beliefs, carnism, veganism, you know, there's a relationship between people, and that's where the attention needs to be if we want to be able to have a productive conversation that leads to, you know, true and lasting change.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that line of thought leads really nicely into my next question. So whereas privilege literacy is, I guess, particularly important for those who wish to be good allies, those who wish to create or recruit allies, a particularly important concept for them is mindfulness. I was hoping you could explain mindfulness to us. I think you've already kind of started, but
yeah. So I write a little bit about this in my book, in The Vegan Matrix, as you're pointing out. And so it's, you know, when I talk about mindfulness, I'm talking about being sort of tuned into your own and another's experience, you know, being able to self-reflect, being able to, if you can, when you feel safe enough, to maintain connection with your empathy and for this other person as you're communicating with them. Not everybody can feel safe enough to stay connected to their empathy. And, you know, and sometimes it's not really the appropriate thing to do. But, you know, mindfulness is one aspect of relational literacy. And, you know, relational literacy is based on, you know, or I should say it's made up of a number of different principles and practices. But at its core is this formula. And I think this formula is probably the most useful sort of piece of information I can share when we're talking about, you know, creating connections, you know, whether they're connections with supporters or, you know, what have you. I call this the formula for healthy relating. Basically, in a healthy interaction or a healthy relationship, I mean, relationships are really just a series of interactions. So in a healthy relationship or interaction, we practice integrity and honor dignity. And this leads to a greater sense of security and connection. And I'll just unpack this really quickly. You know, practicing integrity basically means practicing the universally espoused core moral values of compassion and justice. It means treating another individual the way that you would want to be treated if you were in their position. Practicing respect, right? So that's practicing integrity. Honoring dignity is thinking of, perceiving, and treating the other as having inherent worth. That means you don't see them as any less worthy of occupying space on the planet and of being treated with respect than you or anyone else. So when you practice integrity and honor dignity, this causes you and the other to feel more secure and connected. And this is the core. This is healthy. This is healthy relationality, you know? So any interaction, any communication, I mean, communication is the primary way we relate, you know, any relationship, in any situation, we can practice this formula. It's just simply a matter of degree. Like most things in life, this formula exists on a spectrum. It's not that, like, you know, where either relational is healthy, you know, or non-relational, dysfunctional, you know, an interaction or a relationship is more or less so, you know. And so a non-relational interaction or relationship is one in which we violate integrity and harm dignity. And this leads to a sense of insecurity and disconnection. And so we can always come back to this formula. And, you know, talking about tricky, complicated issues like privilege, you know, it's difficult. It's very, very difficult to do this. And I want to be very mindful of the fact that, you know, when you are speaking out against your own oppression, for example, if you are a member of an oppressed group and you're speaking out about this, you know, it's not really realistic to think that you're going to be like speaking from the formula perfectly and 100% of the time, because you have, you know, a lot of very understandable anger, you know, and frustration. And I don't think we should expect anybody to be communicating perfectly or even close to perfectly when it comes to issues that are, you know, particularly painful and or organized, really organized around such profound injustices. And those of us who are working to raise awareness, those of us who are acting as advocates in one way or another, though anybody, period, you know, the closer we can stick to the formula, the more likely we are to raise awareness of the issue that we're trying to raise awareness of, the more likely we are to open people's minds and hearts to what we're trying to say.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Mindfulness seems like a pretty important thing. But it requires patience, I guess. mm-hmm. It's obviously, I guess, tempting when interacting with someone who you think is complicit in or maybe sort of actively contributing to oppression. It can be difficult to not just be indignant, I suppose, especially if you've been affected by that person's behavior, and especially if you think that they've had like a real opportunity to become privilege literate, but they haven't. It's worth developing that kind of patience, I suppose.
It's patience, and you know, this is also skills, and you know, and it's also about knowing when it's the right time to be communicating, right? And if you have been on the receiving end of oppression, if you've been harmed by oppression, you know, and you're still in a state where you're feeling vulnerable and you're feeling fragile, and you know, then it may not be time for you to be trying to, I mean, you have to have conversations when it feels right for you, obviously, but people need to be, you know, careful and protect their own boundaries. And it's also important to appreciate that, you know, with relational literacy, you know, and building mindfulness, which is a fundamental component of relational literacy, you know, building self-awareness, the ability to be more present and, you know, present in the moment and tuned into your own and others' experiences, building relational literacy is not rocket science. There's a set of skills that anybody can learn if they really want to and they're really committed to doing it. And it doesn't mean you have to like work hard to develop your patience or go meditate somewhere alone in a mountain. You know, you can really use your minute-to-minute communications as training grounds on which to build your own integrity, build your own self-awareness, and build your own, you know, relational literacy. One of my books, it's called Getting Relationships Right, is a one-stop guide to building relational literacy. And, you know, I think for many people, even if they improve their level of relational literacy or increase their level just by like 10%, it can be game-changing for them. I mean, it really makes life so much easier, no matter what you're talking about. I mean, whether you're debating whether to stay in or go out on a Saturday night, or, you know, you're trying to talk about, you know, patriarchy and the vegan movement.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So this next question, is related to some of what you've, already touched on in your response. In chapter 4, you explain that psychologists identify three stages in which recovery from trauma occurs. And you also indicate that we can draw useful lessons from these stages about how to effectively communicate with those who've been harmed by our own privilege, but also lessons about how to effectively communicate with those whose privilege has harmed us. Mm. I was hoping you could explain to us why, I guess, say a bit about what the three stages are, but explain to us why the three stages of recovery is useful for effective communication.
I mean, really, when people have been, affected by oppression, this can very often cause them to have been traumatized. And even if it's not trauma, but the capital T, which it often is, right, it still can cause, a lot of very understandable psychological I don't want to say psychological, not psychological, vulnerability. And, you know, so it's important to, again, know that communication as normal often doesn't apply when you're talking to somebody who has been harmed, particularly who has been harmed by an oppressive system that you are on the privileged, that you occupy a privileged role in. So when we think about healing from trauma, I mean, healing from trauma is, you know, basically, there are three stages in healing from trauma. One is safety. You know, people basically need to feel safe before anything else can happen. The next is acknowledging and expressing the emotions related to the trauma. That can only happen when a person has established safety. And then the third stage is reconnecting with others. And so, you know, very often what we see is that, and you could see this in you know, the animal rights movement when during AR Me Too, you know, people were women women and people of other genders as well sometimes were, you know, advocating the need for safe spaces, and they were being debated on that need, right? And so, you know, when somebody is advocating their need for safety, you know, no matter what reason they're advocating for safety, this is not a time to question it. This is not a time to debate it. You know, communication as normal or as usual can't really happen during this stage. This is a time to listen and learn, you know, and very often, even just like normal questioning can come across as cross-examining or, you know, debating. The same with stage two, acknowledging and expressing the emotions. This is not a time to be focusing on, you know, if you're occupying a privileged position, this is not a time to be focusing on yourself or your needs so much as to be listening to the needs and emotions that are being expressed by other people. Again, you could see what happened in AR Me Too, where a lot of women were speaking out about their victimization, their traumatization. And then there were some men who were actually very well-intentioned. I actually know some of them. This turned into like public conversations, if you can call Facebook public, but conversations on Facebook, you know, where men were expressing, you know, their sadness and their horror at what was surfacing. And, you know, and these feelings were real. These men's feelings were real, you know, and they were real feelings of concern. But what happened was it turned the conversation around to make it about the men's experiences. And then women felt like they had to start caretaking the men's feelings as opposed to like being able to just express their own experiences. So only in stage three is conversation as, you know, communication is normal, more appropriate. So it's important, you know, not to play devil's advocate, as I've said, and listen openly, listen with the goal of growing your awareness. You know, if you're occupying a privileged position situation, try to educate yourself and not ask other people to educate you. This happened to me. I mean, everything I'm talking about happened to me. I experienced, but you know, as I said, when awareness raising finally started happening, a lot of men I was colleagues with who I had tried to talk about this issue before suddenly became open-minded. And then they wanted me to go digging and finding all of the great resources for them. And every time I shared a resource with them, it like wasn't, you know, it wasn't relatable or whatever. And I mean, the good news is that I ended up writing a book, but it would have been nice if, you know, if the conversation had been a little bit different than that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I it's neat how you apply these three stages. I'm not a psychologist, so this is my first time hearing about them. Just reflecting on like sort of pop cultural, or not pop cultural, but I guess public in the media discussions about privilege and about oppression and whatnot. Sometimes I don't think that the public has a considered settled opinion about what it means to be a good ally sometimes. So I think that people who want to be a good ally are sometimes told to shut up and listen. And then other people will say, no, don't shut up and listen. Being a good ally, shutting up and listening is like being complicit or kind of. you should not shut up and listen. You should be supportive and vocally supportive, right? That's important. That's the important thing about being a good ally. And then so for people who are hearing this advice, people who want to be good allies, it's just like, well, what am I supposed to do? This is useful, right? The answer that you're giving here at least is it depends. At the beginning, you should shut up and listen. And then later on, you can be more vocal and supportive, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, and again, when you really understand relational literacy, it's a lot easier because, yeah. You know, the basics of like healthy communication, they apply no matter what. And it does depend. I mean, being a supporter to others, an ally or a supporter to others, it depends, you know, and what it means to one person might be different, and it is different than what it means to somebody else. So ask the person, whoever is asking you to, if somebody is asking you to be an ally, mm-hmm. you can ask, say, what does that look like to you?
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Yeah. Fair enough. Okay. Well, let's. I've got one more question for you, and then we'll close up. But so your book argues that addressing privilege and effectively helping animals are complementary goals. So in other words, your book argues that addressing privilege improves our ability to help animals. I was hoping you could explain this argument and maybe say a bit about why you thought it was important to point this out to everybody.
Well, I mean, often, understandably, I think, you know, yeah. vegans have often said like, well, wait a minute, like there's only so much time in the day. Like I can't work for everything. I can't take on all causes because they assume that like addressing other forms of oppression, you know, requires working for other causes. And, you know, of course you've got to pick your cause and, you know, you got to pick your battles basically. And, you know, but it's, what I'm saying here is that we can work to create a better world for animals, not only without throwing others under the bus as we do that, but as lifting, we can all lift each other up. Because as I said, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we're not just talking about a straightforward change of behavior. We're talking about a shift of consciousness. We're talking about relating in a fundamentally different way. If we want to change the world, we need to change the way we relate, or we're just going to keep recreating oppressions in new forms. So, you know, when we start, I think, first of all, you know, when we are working to create a more, what's the word I'm looking for? Self-aware movement, you know, for animals, a more inclusive movement with more awareness around oppression and around privilege. You know, we help to create a movement that's more resilient. A resilient movement is healthy. It's a movement where advocates feel secure and connected with one another. You know, as I said, in some ways we're cannibalizing ourselves as a movement because we're relating to each other so dysfunctionally. And, you know, when we relate to each other in a way that creates greater security and connection, we create resilience in our movement. That means we're more empowered. That means we're more impactful. That means we are better able to help more animals, you know, or to spare more animals. We can't do that when we haven't examined our own privileges because we end up acting out this dysfunction, you know, with the people in our movement and creating disconnection and insecurity in the movement. And also we end up turning others off to the movement. You know, feminists are a great example. I mean, feminists are, you know, anybody who's working for social justice really are naturally aligned with us, you know, but very often see some of our tactics and get really turned off, you know. So when we use objectified women's bodies to sell animal rights, we turn off a lot of people, you know, we turn off pretty much everybody who's got any kind of analysis around patriarchy. And there's no need to do that. And in fact, it's, you know, as I've said, it's counterproductive to the kind of world we want to create. And it's certainly counterproductive to, you know, creating a resilient and empowered movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And maybe this is related. It strikes me that it's something of, I don't know, I would have said in the past it was a stereotype, like that sometimes people stereotype vegans as a movement of the privileged or something like that. But probably there are ways in which vegans have contributed to that, and that's part of what you're talking about in the book. Like there are some concrete ways in which vegan advocates contribute to the not just the impression that they have privilege, but to the impression that that they're not handling their privilege well. And we should stop doing that. Okay, great. Well, so I thanks so much for joining us here. It's been great having you on the podcast. And for anyone who's forgotten, the name of the book we've been discussing is The Vegan Matrix: Understanding and Discussing Privilege Among Vegans to Build a More Inclusive and Empowered Movement. This book was published in 2020 by Lantern Media and Publishing. The only other question I have for you, Melanie, is whether you're currently working on any projects, and if so, what are they?
Thank you. And thank you for having me. It's been really, really a pleasure talking to you. So we have a few projects in the works at Beyond Carnism. As I think I mentioned, next year, in 2023, my new book, How to End Injustice Everywhere, is coming out. And that's really, it's looking at ways that, you know, whatever form of injustice you're challenging, whether it's injustice against animals, the environment, or, you know, other humans, this book gives a sort of an overview of what a little bit of what we've been talking about, right? Of these non-relational systems, how they're structured, how our own movements and groups can end up internalizing the very mentality that we're trying to transform in the world, and how to avoid that. And a piece of that is also understanding the causes and consequences of infighting in movements and in groups, and ways to navigate, to prevent and manage and overcome infighting. Building on that, we have some new work at Beyond Carnism that is designed really specifically to raise awareness of infighting among vegans. So, and also to build awareness of relational literacy among vegans. So we've got new workshops and new resources for those. We'll have some new SIVA courses. Our Center for Effective Vegan Advocacy has some new courses that we'll be releasing. One is Privilege and Inclusivity in the Vegan Movement, which discusses a lot of what we were talking about here today. We have the Science of Effective Vegan Advocacy, which we've just released. These are two digital courses that I'm referring to. We've got some new vegan communication hacks, which are, you know, basic simple talking points and concepts to utilize when you're trying to have those difficult communications. And the next season of Just Beings will be out. And we're very most likely going to be talking about to people who are working for food systems change. So I'm really excited about doing that. So those are a few of the projects we have. And people can learn more at carnism.org or at veganadvocacy.org.
Yeah, great. Those sound like wonderful projects. Best of luck with all of them.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much.